Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, it was a small enough event in our area that we can have a little fun with yesterday's earthquake, with a little shake, rattle, and roll bringing us in. But we invite your serious earthquake questions right now at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Thankfully, the fallout from the quake up and down the East Coast was minor. No reported injuries still, minimal damage, and mostly bunch of conversations last night over dinner or drinks, like, where were you, right? What did it feel like? Did you think you were having a heart attack? But that doesn't mean the largest earthquake in this region in over a century doesn't bring up a host of questions. Curious questions about what exactly happens during an earthquake, the math questions of the Richter scale, just how much more is a 5.9 than a 5.8? It's not just regular arithmetic. To more serious questions about whether we did, in fact, dodge a bullet, and if we're prepared for a more powerful one. So your earthquake questions right now, 212-433-WNYC, or post them to our website, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, tweet at Brian Lehrer, or Facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC. And here to answer those questions, your questions and mine, are two guests. James Gaherty is a research professor at the Lamont Daugherty Earth Observatory of Columbia University. He'll talk about intraplate seismic events and stuff like that. And architect Lance J. Brown is co-chair of the Design for Risk and Reconstruction Committee of the American Institute of Architects. And we've got questions about building codes and things like that for Lance J. Brown. Lance J. Brown, James Gaherty, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian.
Good morning, Brian.
James, I'm reading reports that this earthquake wasn't just big, it was shallow. So tell us why that's important.
That's important because the shallow events are the ones that really cause the most shaking and the most potential damage, in particular right in the epicentral region where the event occurs. And the deeper you get, the shaking goes down fairly dramatically, and so deep events tend to be a little bit less damaging.
So that's why I'm calling this the Appalachian Trail quake, because they said it was felt from Maine to Georgia, which is exactly the length of the Appalachian Trail. But that's a lot, because it was only half a mile deep.
So it was felt in such a wide region primarily because the rocks in the eastern part of the U.S. just transmit the shaking associated with an earthquake very efficiently, much more efficiently than in the West Coast. And so when you have an event this size, say in California, it's a much smaller radius around that event that feels it, primarily just because the geologic structure is different. It is just much more, what we call it, much more attenuating. The energy dampens out very quickly.
Lance, we know that at the National Cathedral in Washington, there was some damage to the spires. There's a crack in the Washington Monument. That's much closer to the epicenter. But here in New York, I mean, it's amazing, considering that almost everybody felt it. People got really scared if they were in tall buildings or, you know, in a lot of other places. And yet it doesn't even seem that there was a report of a brick coming loose or a scaffolding being jarred or anybody being thrown from a crane, God knows how many stories high. Were we just lucky?
I think we're very, very fortunate. I think we're in an extremely well-built environment. We're at a good enough distance from the epicenter of the event so that the precautions we've taken over time to prevent damage to life and limb or buildings worked fairly well.
Do you think New York's building code... I've heard two different versions of this. I've heard people saying, well, of course, this is scary here because New York isn't built to withstand earthquakes like California is. Then I've heard people say, well, no, actually, anything that's a relatively modern building in New York is built with pretty strong earthquakes in mind.
Well, this is, you know, peeling the earthquake onion, which I like to think of it as, is an interesting exercise. There are a number of different aspects that go into assuring safety in an earthquake instance. There are a category of earthquake zones throughout the United States, I think 1 through 4, from minor to major. There's the nature of the soils that get built upon. There's the height of buildings and the materials that are used. It's a system that we're talking about. It's not a one-line item of any kind whatsoever. I was thinking yesterday that with the amount of shaking that took place, minor as it might have been, you might have expected something to fall off of a tall building, certainly if you saw the images from Virginia, Maryland, whatever, of buildings losing their sheathing, the bricks that came off, but not the structure that failed. New York City has a law that was instituted probably 30 years ago at this point, after a brick fell off a building up on the Upper West Side and hurt a co-ed or killed her, perhaps, where our buildings are inspected for things that might fall off. So we go, I think every building in the city is inspected every 5 years to make sure that there's nothing that might fall from the building and hurt someone on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
If you translate that into the safety factor that adds for potential harm to people on the street during an earthquake event, it's really quite monumental. It means that we've tried to secure the pieces of our buildings that might cause danger, and in some cases, for those of us who've been in New York long enough, we've seen the removal, unfortunately, of a lot of beautiful cornices and other decoration that were deemed at some point to be possibly dangerous because they might fall.
The trade-off of beauty for security. Jose in Queens, you're on WNYC. You had a question about what the seismologist was saying?
Hello?
Hi, Jose.
Yeah, I was just asking about the when they talk about the rock under the eastern seaboard, are they talking about the Marcellus Shale, the thing that they talk about fracking all up and down the East Coast?
Yeah, James, you were talking about the nature of the rock formations on the East Coast that transmits the shaking of the quake very well. Is that Marcellus Shale?
So Marcellus Shale is part of a much thicker kind of sequence of rocks that make up the Earth's crust, and it's not the shale in particular is fairly rigid and probably does propagate energy reasonably well, but it's really taken as a whole, the tectonic activity in the eastern part of the country is really much older, and so it's had a longer time to cool since then, and basically cool rocks transmit energy more efficiently than warm rocks is a very simple physical principle, and then in addition to that, a lot of the complex structure, the big mountain chains in the western U.S. and then next to it a deep basin, for example, if you drive across Nevada, you know, those kinds of changes absorb seismic energy fairly efficiently and scatter it. And so it's sort of a combination of kind of how hot the rock is in a relative sense and also how complicated the structures are that lead to these changes in shaking. It's really not one rock type that would lead to the differences in shaking.
And actually, there are different kinds of bedrock in Manhattan itself. The reason that we have skyscrapers in Lower Manhattan and Midtown, but not elsewhere, is that you can't build on certain kinds of rock or where that rock exists. So did that affect how much it was felt in different parts of the city?
Absolutely. So the tallest buildings tend to, we try to, you know, design them and build them such that they are embedded in good solid bedrock, and there's a lot of that in New York. We've done a lot of landfill around New York and expanded Manhattan, expanded Queens and Brooklyn and the surrounding area to get more land. And that landfill area tends to be much less stable, and so we don't build tall buildings on that. That type of material, the sedimentary material that you'd fill in these fill areas, does shake much more than the bedrock itself, and so it exacerbates the shaking. And so for that reason, I think you can feel it much more in those sedimentary areas, those fill areas. Mm-hmm. But it tends to be smaller buildings there also.
You know, by bringing up the Marcellus Shale, which is the kind of rock that has these natural gas deposits, I think Jose in Queens was getting at another question, and I'm going to let Robin in Westport kind of finish it, I think. Robin, you're on WNYC.
Hey, guys. The state of Arkansas recently shut down all fracking operations because they were causing too many earthquakes. I wonder if something like that might have been going on near the town of Mineral, Virginia, the epicenter of this earthquake.
And so, James, I'm going to stay with you for that. We have a number of callers who are bringing up, and I don't know if that's true about Arkansas shutting down fracking specifically because of earthquakes, but do you know? And there's a lot of anti-fracking. There are a lot of anti-fracking calls coming in saying, hey, let this be a warning to you.
So, absolutely. It's a great question. It's clearly something that, that there are seismologists and non-seismologists alike are worried about. It's there's a long history of humans inducing earthquakes, and we tend to do it when we drill and pump fluids into the ground. The oil industry will often induce very small earthquakes when they do very aggressive kinds of drilling and extraction operations. And when we build reservoirs and fill up reservoirs, we increase the fluid pressure, and that actually enhances earthquake activity. I think the reality is we don't have good documented cases of very significant. We have very few good documented cases of significant earthquakes. So I would call this a very significant earthquake, being induced by that kind of activity. I don't think there's any evidence that in Arkansas, for example, the seismicity was a very low level, magnitude 2, magnitude 3 levels of seismicity, even smaller. And I think it's clearly correlated with the fracking activity there. And I think there was a lot of demonstration of that. And so there have been, I had not been aware that they had shut it down, but yes, there's been a lot of concern about it there. I would be concerned about it around here, too, at a smaller level. I think this event is very likely to be caused by tectonic stresses. To get an event this size, to change the stress regime so that you get an event of this size is very difficult to do with something like fracking.
And we have a caller who says that hydraulic fracking caused an earthquake in England. You don't know that to be definitively proven?
Hydraulic fracking has been shown to cause earthquakes in several instances. I don't know about the case in England that he's referring to, but it absolutely can cause earthquakes, but they tend to be very small.
Lance J. Brown from the American Institute of Architects. After the quake shook our building here at WNYC, our building safety officer got on the intercom and ordered the building evacuated. And we heard that the Pentagon was evacuated and, of course, many other buildings. But then I've heard some second-guessing of that you don't actually evacuate a building, at least not during an earthquake, maybe after. What's the right thing?
I think that there's a complex series of protocols for how to respond to an earthquake, and it depends certainly on what type of building you're in and when it was built and what its structural type is. I generally refer people to the guidelines that the Office of Emergency Management produces for the city of New York, which is specific to our location and which is fairly well informed. I think if you the common wisdom, if you're out in California and the building shakes, is one, get under a table, or if you're in an office, get under a desk. That's in the earliest stages where you actually might not have an easy time getting out of the building. But since there are shocks and aftershocks, I think each one of the people who works as basically the building warden to caution what people should do in an instance are informed enough for their building type to know when they should ask people to evacuate and when it's better to stay in place. And I think it's a specific, I don't think there's a general rule for this because it's so dependent on the nature of the building that you're in, that in one instance it might be a good idea to evacuate, and in the other instance it might be a best thing to stay put.
By the way, listeners, for those of you interested in the relationship between fracking and earthquakes, we have a piece now on our politics website, It's a Free Country, by Stephen Reeder. Go check it out, the relationship between fracking and earthquakes, at itsafreecountry.org. One more call. Alan Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Al.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I'm confused. I heard one seismologist say yesterday that, a 7 on a Richter scale, is 32 times more powerful than a 6. But I heard yet another seismologist a little bit later say that there's only a 10-fold difference. So can your guest or somebody else clear up my confusion?
James Gaherty, give us 30 seconds of Richter scale math.
Sure. Okay. When an earthquake occurs, we can do a very quantitative calculation on how much basically the shaking that was produced back at the source when the earthquake occurred. And we then convert that to a Richter scale using a formula that if you do the math, it comes out to a factor of 30. About 30 is the right number for the difference between magnitude 6 and magnitude 7, between magnitude 7 and magnitude 8. Any one unit on the Richter scale is about 30 in terms of how we calculate what we call the moment, the actual shaking associated with the earthquake.
Why do you use that confusing a scale?
So it's very historical. If the Richter scale was designed back in the 30s to by Charles Richter to quantify earthquakes that were happening in California. And the difficulty is that earthquakes scale over a huge range. So a magnitude 5 earthquake in moment sense has a we use exponential notation even to keep track of it, but 10 to the 17 would be a magnitude 5 in one of the units that we use, and 10 to the 21, 22 is when you start to get up to magnitude 6, magnitude 7. And so that huge a range is hard to quantify, hard to put into a paper. And so if you use a logarithm to convert it to something that's a little bit easier, just units of one change
right,
between
it
these
represents all those zeros.
That's right.
So. Charles Richter once said, logarithmic plots are a device of the devil.
they are.
But,
they
you
are,
know, Gawker.com has a headline up right now that says, Californians are being insufferable about this earthquake. But can you give us a little official seismological permission to overreact a little bit, given that this kind of thing hasn't happened around here in 114 years?
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. The fact that shaking propagates more easily away from these events, it affects a much wider region. And the fact that, you know, they don't happen so much, we don't have a lot of data on them. The reality is that these kinds of events can happen almost anywhere on the eastern seaboard.
So does the fact that we had a 5.8, 5.9 yesterday mean that we are more likely now, in your opinion, than we were 2 days ago, to have a 10 to the minus 17 sometime in our lifetimes?
It's not more likely, it's not less likely, but it means that this was an area that had only very small earthquakes previously in the recorded, in really the human inhabited history of Virginia. The historical record in Virginia goes back 300 years or whatever, and this was the biggest event in that time frame. We could now move up the coast to New York, and we have to go back a few hundred years to have a similar event, but they can happen really anywhere at any time, and I think that's the reality. We need to be prepared for these types of events, and you know, I think we were lucky that this one happened to be in a fairly rural area, but you know, this kind of event is not of the magnitude that they see in California, but at the same time.
But there must be something different. I mean, could happen anywhere at any time is such a blanket statement, but in fact, big earthquakes tend to happen in certain places and not in other places.
So it's the difference between an intraplate earthquake and a plate boundary earthquake. So earthquakes in California are on very well-developed faults that are between very large plates that are moving relative to each other, and we can document the motion on those plates very easily using a variety of techniques, and everything holds together nicely in terms of understanding why we have earthquakes on those kinds of faults. Intraplate earthquakes happen very, very rarely, and we don't have good data on really why they happen. And so there is a very ongoing debate in our community whether, for example, if we drew a hazard map for the eastern U.S., you'll see a red bullseye around central Missouri or southern Missouri, where the New Madrid events happened in early 1800. You'll see a bullseye around Charleston, South Carolina. There are seismologists arguing that those bullseyes are only because we don't see these events very often, and that in fact every place has equal risk all over the eastern part of the seaboard. And it's a very active debate whether those places are hot spots truly or just it's a random occurrence.
Very interesting. Thank you for informing us of that. And Californians, when it snows in San Francisco and everyone freaks out, we won't give you a hard time. Just let us have this moment of panic, okay? James Gaherty, research professor at the Lamont Daugherty Earth Observatory of Columbia University, architect Lance J. Brown, co-chair of the Design for Risk and Reconstruction Committee at the American Institute of Architects. Thank you both so much.
You're more than welcome.
And again, we do have that article on itsafreecountry.org on the relationship between fracking and earthquakes, if you want to check it out. And coming up next, how the NYPD uses mosque crawlers and ethnic neighborhood rakers to prevent a 9/11, another 9/11, according to the AP, though the NYPD denies it. We'll talk to the AP reporter who broke the story. Stay with us.